open public input. Nikki, two things. Would you do the introductory comments to the public and then tell me how many we have signed up to speak?
Yeah. We'll now take public comment from attendees. As a reminder, everyone receives 3 minutes for comment unless the allotted time is modified by the chair at the onset of the agenda item. Everyone is currently muted on the phone and computer. When it's your turn to speak, you will be recognized by your partial phone number or your Zoom username and will be unmuted by staff. You will be asked to state your name for the record just as you were attending the meeting in person. Currently, I have 16 people, probably less than that, but I'm not seeing a lot of names yet because we're really ahead. So,
okay. Well, we'll start off with a 3 minute program. Hopefully we can stay there and hear from everyone. First introduction, Nikki, please.
I'm going to start with Martha Hall. Where are you, Martha? There you are. Okay, Martha, you've been unmuted.
Okay, can you hear me?
We can hear you.
I'm Martha Hall, Anacortes, Washington. I'm here to comment on the department's, how the department addresses issues usually referred to as wildlife conflicts, and I'll mention a few with the time I have. The first one, for years, the department ran a mostly secret program that allowed hunters to use bait and dogs to kill bears on timberlands, using a loophole in a citizens' initiative that prohibited these. When this program was challenged in the courts, the department lost. My question is the department now in the process of developing another special program for killing bears on tree farms? If so, will this state agency be transparent this time around and tell the public what this program is about and how it will be managed? We are waiting to hear. Second one, when researching the department's management of black bears, I was surprised to find out how various staff members responded to calls on black bears. Even though every district has a conflict specialist, there seemed to be no established protocol on how to respond. Some districts were proactive by providing education and working with nonprofits to develop programs like Bear Smart, where neighbors are encouraged to store bear attractants like garbage to prevent bear problems. In other districts, staff was either not familiar with these approaches or not interested in them, and instead address these problems by using recreational hunting, which seldom targets the few bears that might be problem bears. As the human population in Washington State increases and more humans encroach on wildlife habitat, shouldn't this state agency be teaching residents how to live with wildlife instead of just addressing so many problems by increasing recreational hunting? I'm tired of hearing about this, and it pertains to elk and just about every species. This is the department's answer: recreational hunting. Third, time and again, I'm seeing that hunters complain about predators, and the department increases the hunting of cougars and black bears to satisfy their desire to have more ungulates. The current game management plan lays out a rather strict policy of what staff and the commission should do before it kills predators to enhance prey species. Real science is required on pages 19 to 22. Instead of following this plan, the staff and commission have increased recreational hunting of cougars and black bears, claiming that they're using their mandate to provide hunting opportunities. Periodically,
you're at time.
Comes out.
Oh, Martha, thank you for your comments. Would you put those in writing? We do not respond to public questions during the commission meetings, but if you put them in writing, we'll try and get you an answer. How would that work for you?
Yes, I will.
Thank you very much. Next, Nikki.
Let's see. We're going to go with Marie Newmiller. Go ahead, Marie.
Good morning, commissioners. My name is Marie Newmiller, and I'm with the Inland Northwest Wildlife Council. I just wanted to provide quick comment on the Wildlife Committee meeting yesterday. We are very excited to see that the department and the commission are taking up the issue of CWD in our ungulate herds. We learned a lot from yesterday's presentation, and we're looking forward to learning more and participating in that process. We were also excited to see the preview of the predator prey study. We've been following along and are looking forward to seeing the data that comes out of that. We have some questions about where different animals were trapped, and we look forward to learning as that study comes out. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your comments today, Marie. Nikki, next, please.
Next, I'm going to go with David Lynn. Go ahead, David. Make sure to unmute yourself.
Oh, hi, this is David. I'm sorry, I don't have my comments ready yet, so I will pass right now. Thank you.
Okay. Let's see. Let's go with Adrian Tui. Go ahead, Adrian.
All right. Can everyone hear me?
We can hear you.
Great. Well, thanks so much. I'm Adrian Tui, biologist. For the last 6 years, I've been supported by NOAA, WDFW, and the University of Washington as I've led the research effort for the Fish Trap Project in the Lower Columbia. And we've worked hard over the years in collaboration with fishers from the local commercial community. These are the individuals that want to innovate to make a better future for tomorrow. Along with these progressive fishers who support establishment of the emerging commercial fishery, we've worked side by side with WDFW through feasibility studies and test fisheries. What I've seen over the last 6 years gives me hope for the future. Our team has made some pretty amazing progress to revive this fishing technology, modify it for safe release of wild salmon, and shape it for selective, sustainable harvest of hatchery fish to reduce PHAS and add value to harvested products. We started out with recycled nets from a trash bin and days of volunteered time. After developing the first pound net in over 85 years, we performed our initial research of bycatch post-release survival, a metric that Jeremy Jordan from NOAA would tell you is paramount to estimating fishery impacts. For the first time with an alternative gear in the Columbia, the research results were actually peer-reviewed and published, with bycatch survival ranging from 94.4 to 99.5% for steelhead and chinook. Since 2017, we've made major advancements, achieving 100% post-release survival results for coho and sockeye, a result that hasn't been achieved by any other gear. These results were also peer-reviewed and published in the North American Journal of Fisheries Management, a stamp of approval from scientists of the highest caliber. Now, I'm really proud of every study we've conducted to date, which has undoubtedly produced some of the best alternative gear science in the basin. And we're going to keep this promising effort going. Results to date suggest that the fish trap is one of the best tools available for targeting hatchery fish and releasing wild fish unharmed. From what I've seen, this is just the tip of the iceberg for the gear. And with further innovation from an emerging fishery, it seems very clear to me that the fish trap will likely be a selective tool for the future. From the research we've conducted, I encourage the director to also remain hopeful and allow for innovation in this fishery. We need innovation from progressive fishers to help get us out of this mess. The emerging fishery and alternative gear just seems wise, not to mention it's also state policy. Give fishers options and let's start adapting to the pressures that we're facing. Thank you very much.
Adrian, this is Larry Carpenter. I have one question for you. I learned yesterday during the meeting that from someone, or I read it, I'm not exactly sure now, that the existing pound net that you've operated for a number of years is not going to be utilized this year. Is that correct?
I don't think a determination has been made, Larry. I think if there was an emerging fishery, I imagine it might be considered for operation.
Okay. Is there funding considerations too, or is it just approval?
Oh, and we're going to be running conducting more research at a site in Clifton Channel in Oregon, and that'll be to hopefully further confirm 100% survival rates for steelhead and Chinook salmon. So that research will continue. As for an emerging fishery and the site in Cathlamet, I think that's up to the fishermen and the department here to decide.
Thank you, Adrian. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Next, Nikki.
Next, we are going to go to Rachel Bjork, followed by Robert Sudar. Rachel. Go ahead, Rachel.
Good morning. Thank you for, and commissioners, thank you for allowing this time for public comment. So first of all, I'd like to second Martha Hall's comments, and I do appreciate her thorough review of department materials. I also appreciate Commissioner Kuntz's history summary on Thursday. I really think the commission ought to just, you know, come up with an agreed idea of what conservation means. And I don't really think that the mission of making sure that people can take wildlife is necessarily compatible with preserving and protecting the intrinsic value of wildlife and wildlands. Wildlife and wildlands do have intrinsic value, and continuing to expand hunting and fishing opportunities just because people enjoy this pastime often results in an imbalance in the ecosystem. Furthermore, I'm really confused as to why lead shot in particular is still allowed when we know how very dangerous it is to animals that you are not even trying to kill. We absolutely must protect wild spaces, and I hope that the department will do that with a view of the ecosystem as a whole. Was a little disappointed that Commissioner Smith is only on one committee. It does seem like you're trying to limit her participation and effectiveness as a commissioner if she's only allowed to just sit in on and participate in one committee. So I do hope those assignments will be rethought. Finally, I would appreciate it if announcements about these meetings could be sent out earlier than the week of. I do try to pay attention to when these meetings happen. They are really important to me. But if I only receive the announcement for this Monday on this announcement for this meeting on Monday, and that really does not give much time in order to read up on the agenda and prepare for public comment, not to mention to try and find time for people to attend. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for your comments, Rachel. Next, Nikki, please.
Next, we are going to do Greg King, followed by David Lynn. Go ahead, Greg.
Good morning, Chair Carpenter, Director Sue Swin, Commission. My name's Greg King. I'm representing Puget Sound Anglers Lower Columbia River Chapter. I'm here this morning to speak about Pound Net Policy C-3620. The purpose of the policy, the very beginning of it, the objective of this policy are to promote orderly fisheries, particularly in waters of Washington and Oregon, and having concurrency jurisdictions, advance the conservation and recovery of wild salmon and steelhead, and maintain and enhance economic well-being and stability of the fishing industry in the state. So the concurrency part that I'm worried about is the pound nets that were the pilings that were drove over on the Clifton Channel. We had no public comment. We had no open transparency on this issue. It was there 2 weeks ago. Boom. And I'm hearing that Wild Fish Conservancy is claiming a zero mortality. That's laughable. We have mortality in every fishery we had. We had NOAA fisheries come in and claim and say they had to correct that there's a 6-7% mortality rate. Sports fishing has assigned a 10% mortality on these and on other. And that's just, there is mortality in all our fisheries. It's just a known fact. For them to come in and say there's zero mortality, that's just, it's laughable. These pound nets were outlawed 1938. That was done by sportsmen. That's who was outlawing these things. You know, we have to get hatchery fish on the Columbia River back to our hatcheries so we can use them in the recovery of wild salmon. How are we going to do that if we're taking, we have 30 pound nets? They're talking about 30 pound nets on the Columbia River. Is it just, you know, I don't know. I think that Director Seuss, when you're getting into a hot area here of legality, and it's, I hate to see that you go down that path. It's not good for sports fishing. Not at all. I mean, they're only passing wild fish above. How does that work? We have to release them, and we have a 10% mortality rate. So anyway, I'm really upset about this, guys. I really hate these pound nets. They're not going to work for anybody. They're averaging $24,000 a year. So let's take four of you commissioners and put you out there, and you survive on $6,000 a year fishing on a pound net. I don't think you're going to do it. It's not feasible for the commercial guys, and it's not fair to those guys. Anyway, that's my public comment this morning, and thank you.
Thank you, Greg. Next, Nikki.
Next, we're going to do David Lynn, followed by Robert Sudar. Okay, David, you're unmuted.
I'm still nothing. I was working on some comments for today, but they didn't come together as I was finishing it last night. So I'll pass until tomorrow. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. All right, next we're going to do Robert Sudar. Okay, go ahead, Robert.
Yeah, thank you. This is Robert Sudar from Longview, commercial advisor for the Columbia. I do want to comment on the proposed emerging fishery permit for the pound net and other gears. I want to point out that Wild Fish Conservancy did a bit of a media blitz trying to get people to call in and support of this. They had their claims of 0% mortality. Peer-reviewed or otherwise, those results only count once the Technical Advisory Committee for the Columbia agrees to them. And that has not happened. They have other values that they are using that were approved by TAC. And that's been one of the problems, is that they haven't been low enough. And until they present new data that is reviewed by TAC and approved, then no matter what they put in their blog, it doesn't matter. That's beside the point until they can get the Technical Advisory Committee to agree. We heard these similar kind of comments in 2012 when this policy was formulated, how great the seines were going to be. We pointed out at that time, you don't have any data through TAC yet. You don't know what you see in a net or at a boat or at a trap is important, but it doesn't necessarily reflect the long-term impact on the fish. And once the data came out, seines were no longer as viable an option. And that's the same place we are with the trap right now. We don't have data that is complete enough to show the original data was not supportive enough of traps. The new data may be better, but we don't know that yet. And to provide an emerging fishery is out of step with where you are in this process. I actually asked the question about whether or not the trap was going to get used this year at the meeting the other day, and Wild Fish Conservancy said they were going to be focused on Oregon, and the owner of that trap had dropped off the line and has not responded whether he'd use it. But in the past, he had said it's not ready for regular use yet at a previous meeting. So you're offering an emerging fishery permit for a gear that we don't even know if anybody's going to use it. Has anybody been asking to use seines? It just seems so out of step to be pushing this. I don't understand the goals. I understand the marketing aspect of it. That fits into what I do. I would like to see them be able to show if they can really market fish better than I can. I just, it's a lot different to talk about than it is to do it. And in my 35 plus years of doing it, I've learned a lot about how challenging it is to get markets, to keep markets, to provide the fish they want. We put ice on our boats. We bleed the fish. I ice them as I buy them. It's not like the fishery we had 30 or 40 years ago. It's a much different, the gillnet fishery is much different. We take good care of the fish and they get a great acceptance in the marketplace. And so I would like to see the trap be able to try that and to show what they can really accomplish. But the emerging fishery permit is a step ahead. So I encourage you to rethink this idea. It's pushing ahead of where the science is on this. You can't just do by what you think it is. You got to have the approval from TAC that shows what they believe, what those scientists believe the mortality rates really are. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments today, Robert. Next, Nikki.
Next, we're going to go with Irene and Kent Martin. Go ahead, you've been unmuted.
Do you have us now?
We do, go ahead.
All right, thank you very much. Commissioners, I'm Kent Martin, a commercial fisherman from Skamakwa, Washington. Irene and I listened in on the Fish Committee meeting yesterday, March 23rd, and we felt the staff presentation on emerging commercial status for the pound net fell far short. Some commissioners, I think, and even some staff members have not grasped that selective harvest is about numbers of dead fish, not percentages. Percentages conceal actual numbers of dead fish, and the bottom line is not how many fish are released, but how many die. Which leads me to my second point. I suspect some of the emails you received have been generated by the Wild Fish Conservancy's claim on its website that their release mortality from the pound net is zero. That is a shameless lie. Fortunately, NOAA representative was present at the Wednesday Alt-Gear meeting and bluntly said NOAA and TAC committee, which is an adjunct of USV Oregon, has said no such thing. For 2021, the release mortality from the pound net is 5% for steelhead, 7% from fall chinook, and 9% from coho. That number may well change. I would expect it will, but it ain't gonna go to zero. For one thing, marine mammal kills haven't been calculated, even though the tangle net fishery has charged 2% for them. Fishermen are very wary of any technology that will cost well into six figures and only allow the sale of clipped Thule fall chinook and clipped coho. There's $1 million in alt gear laying in warehouses, and we still are not fishing. We trusted you once. I was there and heard all the flowery speeches at the passage of 3620, policy 3620, and none of those promises have come to fruition. Finally, there is no technology that will selectively harvest hatchery fish and not generate vehement opposition from some sectors of the recreational fishery. The commission and the department needs to pull up its socks and deal with that issue. Otherwise, it will never go away. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments, Kat. Next, Nikki.
Go ahead.
Okay, Irene Martin here. I wouldn't be testifying today if it weren't for the fish. I've spent nearly 50 years working on salmon recovery, improving habitat, experimenting with gear, and have watched the negative social statistics rise in the impoverished fishing communities that surround me and that have been deprived of their access to a resource they have depended on for generations. I spent the last couple of years in advisory committee meetings to work on resolving issues, to try and create better fisheries, improve salmon survival and recovery, and I am deeply disappointed in the emerging dynamic at WDFW. The commercial fishermen's work, both in license reduction and alternative gear, is ignored. Policy is designed that goes against all the advice the commercial fishery has given, and then we are somehow expected to make it work. I'll be very blunt. You've been given false information about the pound net. I expect you've all seen the petitions and flyers and emails touting zero mortality. It is not true. At the alternative gear meeting this past Wednesday, a representative of NOAA Fisheries flatly told us what TAC, USV Oregon, and NOAA are accepting at this time for mortality rates for the pound net. The rate is not zero. That is a fabrication. Looks good on paper, but not true in the water. Being blunt again, these mortality rates pose a risk to the fish. They seem like small percentages, but in fact, in a pound net with large catches of fish, they represent large numbers of dead fish. Not all the science has been done on the pound net. Steelhead mortality studies and marine mammal encounter rates and mortalities have not been done. PHAS information is not available. The economics are ludicrous, as we have pointed out in documents you should have all received by now. The science was done on one trap in one location, which turned out to be a steelhead haven. You are taking a big risk with the fish and should be doing serious risk analysis before embarking on this emerging commercial fishery designation. Would you accept the results of science done on one gillnet fishing in one location? Of course not, nor should you with the fish trap. Another trap is being tried, this time in Clifton Channel. Why not give it a year in order to get some data from that locale and also to complete the science on the Kathlamet Channel trap? You will have a much better foundation to analyze whether this gear has any commercial potential and to do some much-needed risk analysis. On a personal level, I have watched the department rush into these projects regarding alternative gear for some 20 years now. The TangleNet live box combination worked, but now we aren't allowed to use it in the spring, which kind of tempers enthusiasm over alternative gear. Fishermen worked on the purse seine and the beach seine. Some of my friends lost $100,000 on those experiments. I'm not willing to see that happen again. And I think the commission and the department owe it to the fishermen and the fish to do the science right. Do the risk analysis and not rush into yet another alternative that ends up as a crushing and expensive failure that could damage the salmon runs and cause yet more damage to our communities. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments, Irene, today. Next, Nikki, please.
Next, we're going to go with Stephanie Taylor, followed by Dale Maggart. Let's see. Go ahead, Stephanie.
Hi, Nikki. Can you bump me to the end real quick? I'm sorry.
Sure, absolutely. Dale Maggart. All right, Dale, are you ready? Make sure to unmute yourself.
Let's move on. We'll come back, Nikki, please.
Oh, wait a minute. Maybe I got it. Did I get it that time?
You got it.
Yep, you got it.
Well, I really wasn't going to speak this morning. My name is Dale Maggart. I'm the secretary to the Northeast Washington Wildlife Group, and I'm sure my name is kind of familiar with most of you over there. There's been quite a bit of stuff going back and forth here recently. So, and like I said, I didn't know how this format was going to work, and so I'm not really ready, but I'm going to kind of slam through a few things here. Sounds like we had a little bit of fishing issues. I'm going to get into the hunting a little bit. And I, quite frankly, I'm just completely confused and, you know, been going around in circles and so on and so forth. But just a brief rundown on it. You know, on January 7th, the Wildlife Committee was presented with the hunting things, you know, the options, their objectives, Brock was and improve hunter satisfaction relative and retain late season opportunities and so on and so forth. At the end of the presentation, recommended, both he and Anise recommended that they stay with the status quo over here for our hunting. And only 36% of the people supported it, you know, in the 3-year season, stay in status quo, but they did anyway, or reduce the late big buck to 8 days, well, maybe later on, they added later, maybe a 9-day season. And it was in that presentation, the 9-day season was for the November 7th through the 15th. And so then later on, there was a lot of back and forth, different things. There was some confusion about on a press release. And then the CR2-102 was filed with two options, stay with the status quo, or 9-day with hard dates of November 11th through the 19th. So that changed from what they had proposed in the original proposal, I guess. But now it looks to me like, I guess, they say they received 144 comments in opposition to this proposal and only 3 in support. And I'm jumping down here now for a little ways. Interesting, of the 158 comments on GMU 105 and 121, there were 9-day season, there were 3 in favor. Opposed to a 9-day season, 44, implement an APR, 64. And of course, that's the bugaboo that we've been pushing over here for quite some time, and it just doesn't get any traction, although that is the more preferred option of anything. And now, today, yesterday, whenever, looking through, now it appears to me like the status quo is off the table. I may be mistaken here, because the recommendations, this is from page 25, is to shorten the general late modern season to a standard 9-day season with season dates of November 11th through the 19th. However, that got changed because now they've thrown in the 2 full weekends. And so for the first year, it's going to run for 14 days, I believe it is. The second year, it's going to run for 15 days, and then the third year it would be an actual 9-day season. So I just don't know what you guys are trying to do. Everybody's against a reduction in season, 93% in your survey, and yet here's 44%, or 64 people out of 150, so what, that's a third, are in favor of an APR over here. And we asked for an APR for one unit to build some science over here. We can't get anywhere with it, and now you're sticking us with a reduction in season that nobody wants. That really isn't going to be effective for the first 2 years anyway. It's almost absolutely no change. Thank you. I'm sorry.
Dale, thank you for your comments today. Next, Nikki.
Next, we are going with Aaron Jorgensen. Go ahead, Aaron. Make sure to unmute yourself. There, maybe. Okay, we will try. Let's see.
Does that work?
Oh, yes. Yep, there you go. Perfect.
Thank you. Yeah, my name is Aaron Jorgensen. I'm a biologist with the Wild Fish Conservancy, and thank you for the opportunity to voice my public comment. Over the past 6 years, I've co-led the trap operations and research at the Pound Net and Cathlamet. I'd just like to briefly reiterate that this gear has shown enormous potential as marked selective commercial fishing gear. The test fishing operations in 2018 and 2019 and 2020 indicate that the fish trap can catch commercially viable numbers of hatchery and Chinook coho while successfully releasing all bycatch with zero immediate mortality to adult salmon and high post-release survival for all salmon it's encountered. Seems to me that allowing this gear to continue down its already impressive track by designating emerging fishery will open the door to fully demonstrate its commercial viability. I can tell you firsthand that the test fishery is not the setting to fully demonstrate the gear's full potential. We work as fast as we can to measure each fish, to scan for pit tags, collect genetics, as does WDFW when working on commercial samples. But at the end of the day, there's a lot of limitations to commercially operating in a test fishery setting. All the great work that the commercial fishers like Blair Peterson and Mike Clark have done, and all the great work that WDFW biologists have done, as well as Wild Fish Conservancy over the past 6 years, demonstrates that this gear is ready for the next step. I'll tell you as a commercial fisher myself that this trap is a great way to catch salmon and one of the only ways to efficiently sort hatchery fish from wild fish. This is in contrast with a gill net that unfortunately harvests wild salmon indiscriminately. As for steelhead, no post-release data have been gathered for the gill net, making estimation and comparison of bycatch impacts impossible. It's been a little overwhelming to hear some of the disinformation that's been spread about the gear, but if you have any questions about the post-release survival for the gear, I would highly recommend that you read our peer-reviewed publications that are out there for everybody. At the end of the day, I think this is a tool with a lot of potential benefits to management and commercial fishers. And by adding this tool to the toolbox, it's going to open the door for future innovation. I think the Columbia River could be a gold standard demonstrating a well-managed terminal, fully selective, stock selective, mark selective fishery that other salmon fisheries up and down the coast can look to for an example. As a member of Wild Fish Conservancy, I guarantee you we are not pushing forward a gear that's going to demolish wild salmon runs. I think we have a reputation for protecting those fish. I hope that you read all the papers, that you take it all into consideration when making this decision. This isn't going full tilt unregulated into the future where we're going to demolish salmon runs. I think this is a great opportunity to move this gear forward and to work together with management, commercial fishers, and I look forward to being a part of it. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments, Aaron. Next, Nikki, please.
Next, we're going to do David Moskowitz. Go ahead, David.
Good morning. Thank you, Nikki, and good morning, Chair Carpenter, members of the Commission. My name is David Moskowitz with the Conservation Angler, based in Edmonds, Washington. In January, we spoke to you about the importance of cold water refugia in the Columbia River for wild salmon steelhead migration. And just to reiterate on that, when the Columbia warms during the summer and hits 68 degrees, salmon steelhead will linger in cold water refugia for days and weeks. And when that water heats up a mere half degree, the residency within a cold water refugia lasts for weeks and months. The cold water refugia are essentially beads on a chain, and they provide wild salmon and steelhead, as well as their hatchery counterparts, with vital respite as they make their journeys to their home waters. And many of these are in Washington. The Kalama, the Cowlitz, Lewis, the Wind River, Little White Salmon, and the Klickitat. However, the fish using these refugia and the refugia themselves are under threat. Cold water refugia are the best places to catch fish, so anglers gather there in numbers, and their efforts adversely impact survival of the very fish we're trying to protect and restore in the Columbian Snake Basin. These rivermouth sanctuaries already ban commercial fishing, so you've already taken that area out of the commercial fishing areas. Yet anglers can gather there in numbers and do impact these fish when that water temperature is high and when the fishing pressure is high. The EPA has studied this issue quite a great deal. They finalized their report on the importance of cold water refugia in January. And one of the key things about that is that they, if nothing changes, that by 2040, the existing cold water refugia will not support salmon migration in the Columbia. That's less than 20 years away if we do nothing. When I spoke in January, Commissioner McGeisick pointed to your new policy, C-3620, as addressing this issue. And I'm going to go to that policy really quickly, which is on page 7 and 8 of the policy. And it talks about the importance of these areas. And then it says the department will strive to convene a joint policy level body to review available information, develop a report with recommendations on possible sanctuaries for consideration for possible concurrent regulations. This is not a recipe for action. You have the information in front of you of the location and the significance of these areas, and you also have information on the effect of angling on the fish that rely on these areas to make it back to their home waters. Oregon has already acted, and they've designated 3 cold water refugia as thermal angling sanctuaries at Eagle Creek. Okay, thank you. I'll try to close here. This is a perfect opportunity for the commission to take action and not just wait. This is why we're not recovering our fish in the Columbia, because these policies don't have any timeline, no objective implementation standards, and no process for action. We urge the commission to direct staff to protect these known areas to protect wild salmon and steelhead. There's only 1,000 wild B-run steelhead forecast to return to the Columbia, the lowest, third lowest in history, and all those low times have been in the past 5 years.
Okay, David, it really
Thank you. Appreciate it. Yeah, it just demands action, and not just a policy consideration. Thank you very much. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for your comments today, David. Nikki, next, please.
Next, we're going to do Pat Hesselgesser. And Pat, please let me know if I said your name wrong. Go ahead. You've been unmuted.
Can you hear me?
We can hear you.
Okay, yes, you said my name correct. Thank you, Nikki. Commissioners, thank you so much for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Pat Hesselgesser. I live in Ellensburg, Washington, and I represent the grassroots volunteers of Trout Unlimited today. We urge you to allow commercial fishers to fish sustainably in the lower Columbia River by approving the use of fish traps through the emerging commercial fisheries process. We know that new research has shown that contemporary fish trap designs allow fishers to safely release wild salmon and steelhead with nearly 100% survival rates and show the greatest potential of any other gear type to further improve to completely eliminate bycatch mortality for all wild salmon and steelhead. I urge you to look at the data as the gentleman from Wild Fish Conservancy has, because there has been some misinformation about the current fish traps that are being talked about today. I urge you to allow commercial fishers to strive to fish sustainably and have the opportunity without using gill nets. We would like to see an end to gill net fishing because of the mortality it causes to salmon and steelhead. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments today, Pat. Next, Nikki, please.
Next, we're going to go with Frank Ha. Go ahead, Frank. You've been unmuted. Make sure to unmute your end.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Good morning, Frank.
My name is Frank Haw, and thank you very much for this opportunity. And thank you, commissioners, for donating your important public service. I worked for the Department of Fisheries for 27 years as a fisheries manager and under two governors as deputy and acting director. Following my service with the Department of Fisheries, I was a senior biologist for Northwest Marine Technology for 20 years. During that period, I worked to implement mass marketing of hatchery salmon, including the development of the equipment to do so, so that we could identify fish, hatchery fish intended for harvest. The only way we can have viable recreational and commercial salmon fisheries and restore our wild populations is to target stocks intended for harvest. Hatchery salmon, with few exceptions, are produced to harvest, and catching too few is damaging to wild populations. Legalizing fish traps on the Columbia River and elsewhere is a significant step toward rational fisheries management. Thank you very much for this opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Frank. Good to hear from you. Okay, next, Nikki.
See, we've got three left. Stephanie, we're gonna try you again. You've been unmuted.
Okay, great, thanks. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you for the opportunity to comment today. My name is Steph Taylor, and I'm commenting today on behalf of the Northwest Animal Rights Network, a region-wide organization serving members throughout Washington. First, I want to say that we second Martha Hall's comments from this morning. They were very well-researched and presented, we feel. Second, I'm growing increasingly concerned with the mouthpiece publishings that are coming out of this commission from biased commissioners who continue to protect special interests. In what if wildlife commissioners who serve Washington feel like hunting opportunities, ones that serve less than 5% of Washington's population, are truly under attack, so much so to draft public opinion pieces that seek to divide constituents between wildlife advocates and hunters, then perhaps it's time to take a step back and take a bigger view and maybe even take a step down from the position of representing the entire state and instead pivot to representing the special interest hunting groups that they are so concerned about. Washington residents care about conservation and flourishing wildlife populations first and recreational opportunities second. We want commissioners who will represent the values of all constituents who seek to bring stakeholders to the table. Washington wants to trust that our wildlife commissioners have the best interests in mind for all constituents, and that includes the wildlife that reside here, as well as those who enjoy protecting wildlife. It is absolutely necessary to protect these wild spaces. The department must do that with a view of ecosystems as a whole.
Allowing people to hunt and kill predators like cougars and bobcats is incompatible with caring for the ecosystem. Allowing people to chase and kill bears with hounds on private timber lands and providing grazing rights on public lands to non-native ungulates is inconsistent with the goal of protecting wild spaces and wild animals. And we will be submitting more substantial comments on the black bear hunting issue shortly. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments, Steph. Next, Nikki.
Okay, the last two I have is Tim Adderson and Bryce Devine. I don't see them listed on here. If either of you are on the phone, please raise your hand. Other than that, do you want me to try to unmute? So I've got Mike Hurst and Kevin Vela's hands up, but I don't know if that's them or not.
Well, we're going to do two. And so whatever you want to do, let's get these two up and let's hear from them, please.
Okay. All right, Mike, you've been unmuted.
Can you guys hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay. So I wasn't going to talk this morning on this particular, but a couple things that I don't think people understand is I don't know where this bashing of the hunting community is coming from. I wish that they would do a little bit more research and figure out who pays for a lot of the wildlife management that happens in the state, not only in the state, but federally. Maybe they should look up the Robertson-Pittman Act, which hunters imposed on themselves, 11% tax. That money goes to state and federal management of wildlife. Billions of dollars have been raised for this tax. And this all came about because of market hunting. You know, that's why we got rid of market hunting. And people realized that they wanted to preserve the resource, and we're the ones that implemented it. I don't know why no one else, they don't know about it, or they don't care about it. We're the ones that are paying for it and helping to manage this. And it doesn't just benefit the game species. It benefits a ton of other non-game species for land acquisitions and habitat improvement. Just because we hunt doesn't mean that we don't care about the management of these critters. I love seeing them out on the landscape. And there have become more and more, like the bears. I can't tell you how many times I've seen bears just out hiking. I do hunt bears, but I also like to see them. And I know that people who don't hunt cannot comprehend that. We love them just as much as you. It's just in a different way. We love the animal, you guys love the individual, we like the species. And I've said it over and over again, you have to manage wildlife and not feelings. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for your comments today, Mike. Okay, Nikki, one more, please.
Okay, finally, we've got Kevin Vela. You're unmuted, Kevin. Let me know if I said your last name wrong.
No, you got it. Thank you. And I apologize. I thought that I had registered, but I may have done it in the incorrect location. So good morning, commissioners. Good morning, commission staff. And good morning, Washington Department Fish and Wildlife staff. My name is Kevin Vela. I am the Pacific Coast District Biologist for the National Wild Turkey Federation, which means that I cover California, Oregon, Washington, and the state of Nevada. I'm here to talk about today about the proposed change for Washington Administrative Code 220416010, particularly the adding of rimfire rifles to the fall season for wild turkeys. The National Wild Turkey Federation has a lot of concerns with this. We do not support this proposed change. Our concerns are multifaceted. The first is the potential for wound loss on birds while utilizing rimfire rifles. The kill zone on a wild turkey on their body is about a baseball-sized portion. They're typically always moving. You're not going to get a whole lot of standing still turkeys. And that kill zone is especially hard to hit with a rimfire rifle at distances greater than the effective range of a shotgun. So that's the first concern that we have. The second concern that we have is hunter safety. when you add rifles into the mix, you create a new concern for hunter safety in the wild turkey woods. So some of the research that's been done, the National Wild Turkey Hunting Safety Task Force has made several findings and recommendations on this topic. Particularly, statistics show that hunting fatalities are more likely to occur when a rifle is involved in a turkey hunting incident. So that's one of the biggest concerns that we have. We want all of our members, all of the hunters, to recreate responsibly and to be able to come home to their families each day. So that's the second concern that we have. We've got a full letter that we're going to be submitting to the commission for this, so I'm not going to go into full detail on it. But I will say that we have worked with the excellent department staff to come up with a potential compromise, and that has been to restrict the use of rimfire rifles to the modern firearm deer and elk season timeframe in October and November each year, when there's currently a hunter orange requirement for all hunters in the field. We believe that most of the fall wild turkey hunters aren't going to be in the field in this time anyways because of that hunter orange requirement. And if they are, we know that how much more safe everyone is in the field when wearing hunter orange. So that's what I wanted to get through today. Thank you very much for your consideration. And we look forward to working with both the commission and the department on wild turkey management in the future.
Thank you for your comments today, Kevin. Okay, Commissioner McIsaac.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm presuming we're done with the open public comment period here. And at this time, at the end of public comment, rather than during public comment, we are going to have the ability to speak a little bit to what we've heard. So I have two matters here, but the first one doesn't have to do with the open public comment we just received verbally, but rather in writing. around March 19th, preceding this meeting, we got a letter distributed to us dated March 18th from Klickitat County Commissioners regarding e-bikes. So I think it's eligible for us to talk about written public comment here as well. It's rare that we get letters from county commissioners, and we do like to honor those with some respected process. So this came up at a lot of verbal public testimony at either the February or the January meeting or both. So I just wanted to let commissioners know that when we get to future meeting planning, I'd like to bring up the county commissioner's suggestion on e-bikes. I know also that there's something going on in the legislature about e-bikes with regard to direction to the department. And maybe when we hear the director's report, this will get modified to some degree, but that's just kind of an alert. The second thing has to do with all the testimony we just heard on the emerging gear, commercial gear designation. And there's some confusion about what's actually in play here. I didn't quite get my hand raised enough after the Fish Committee report. But yesterday we did hear from the director that he was interested in what the commissioners think about this. So when we get to the director's report, this was going to come up, and I'll just hold my comments for that, even though we may just have a brief discussion. The whole matter, though, of in the procedure of open public comment and how that gets integrated into the commission process does come to mind. In a way, this reminds me a little bit of the coastal steelhead management situation that occurred in early December. And so whenever there's an issue that involves a lot of policy change, or considerable policy change, or a matter where there's a lot of interest in what appears to be a large policy change, I think it's good that we have asked the director if he can anticipate those things in advance and schedule some time for commissioner communication. We're seeing the fallout of that on Coastal Steelhead now, and I think it's a good move what we're doing later in the year on that. But on this one here, obviously, it's a big policy change. We've got a petition out there. We've got all this public comment. And so for future matters like this, I think procedurally it'd be nice to have more than a reactive time at public comment or a Fish Committee meeting with, well, in the case of December, 500 people involved. It's also at the end of public comment where we can deal with factual matters that we weren't going to try to challenge anybody who was bringing forward things, but it is a good a good thing for commissioners to know some of the factual matters that are being claimed there. And the one that comes up here today is this matter of catch and release mortality in the trap operations. We heard different values there. And so it might be good if staff can correct me if I'm wrong, but I also did listen to that alternative gear meeting, and I did hear them say that for 2021, the TAC approved catch and release mortality rate for trapping operations for any amount that would involve the public fishery or calculations into the allowable impact total for the fishing seasons would be 6% for steelhead, 9% for Chinook, and an intermediate rate of 7 or 8% for coho. Now, I do understand that there's some problems or some concerns with either the control or the treatment on the experiments that were used to try to measure this. And while there's confidence by some that this will be confirmed at rates near zero, the true peer group that makes a difference on this is the USV Oregon multi-agency peer review group. And so we'll see how that goes for the future. And I hope people will add more data, but 6 to 9% does compare in the spring to 10% for sport fishing, 12% for tangle nets, both of those without a sea lion tag on, and neither the pound net having a sea lion addition as well. And something around 30% or a little bit more for gillnet. So as we move forward into the next discussion on that, if those figures are not accurate, I think it'd be good for us to keep that in mind as we move forward. And I'll save the rest of it for the director's report.
Thank you, Commissioner McIsaac. Commissioner Kuntz, you did have your hand up. And if I may, Director, did you want to speak here before we go on to the next item, director's report?
I wanted to ask Don a question. I missed the meeting where the TAC put out the estimated mortalities. Was the change, was it the immediate mortality, or was it the anticipated total return mortality?
It was survival to spawning grounds was the intent. So
right. So there's really not a discrepancy between the published report about the immediate mortality. And then is there an estimate on the immediate mortality in gillnets?
Yeah, my understanding is that those figures I all rattled off were the survival, not just the immediate survival, but the long-term survival. And
it's really a little bit like comparing apples and oranges then.
Well, no, let me say the apples to apples comparison would be TAC will be using a 6 to 9% species specific long-term mortality for trap caught fish, a 10% long-term mortality for sport caught fish and released, a 12% mortality for tangle nets, and a 2% additional for 14, maybe it's 15, for sea lion impacts. So those are all not immediate mortalities. It's not a mixture of immediate and long-term. That's apples to apples long-term.
No, okay. Thanks for the clarification. But what I meant was we've heard different testimony today and, you know, 0 versus 7% or whatever. But again, actually, they were talking about different things. They were talking about immediate and long-term. It's a different issue on which of those we should consider. But I just wanted to say that, you know, it wasn't like really a difference in the numbers. It was a difference in what the numbers were representing. So thanks for the clarification, Don.
Well, I thought I was hearing in public testimony the claim that the long-term mortality would be at zero or near zero. That's immediate mortality at zero, but also long-term mortality. And it may be that studies are going to get to refine that number, but that's what I was hearing. And that's why I think we should keep apples to apples numbers together.
Yeah, I don't think we have enough information to know exactly what we're talking about yet, would be my feeling. Kelly, did you want to speak before I go to Commissioner Smith?
No, go ahead to Commissioner Smith first, I think.
Thank you, Kelly. Okay, Commissioner Smith, please.
Yeah, this question is for Kelly, though.
Kelly, I read the paper that was done, published and peer-reviewed on the existing experimental pound net on the Columbia. And as I recall, their results were 95 to 97%, and I think even veering towards the 97% survival. And, you know, that was kind of conservative to the spawning grounds. So that doesn't jive with what we're hearing here. Can you comment on the weight that the department would give that peer-reviewed paper?
Sure, I can take a stab at it. It would be hard to jive with what we're hearing today because we're hearing everything, frankly. And so you can't really jive with everything. We do have TAC approved numbers. Those are the numbers that I will consider when I go forward. I think the designation would allow room to refine those, but we have what we need, I believe, to make a decision based on the USV Oregon TAC approved numbers. And I think Commissioner McIsaac is correct on those 6 to 9. That, and I will touch on this a little bit more as I'm trying to check off and decide what's already been covered and what's been covered differently on my report to come up. So we obviously value peer reviewed. Ultimately, we have an agreement that we're going to work with the peer review that ultimately counts is the TAC peer review. We have that at this point. Folks are hoping it'll go lower. We'll see where that lands. And the other thing, before we jump into the actual report, if that's where you're headed, Chair Carpenter, excuse me. And I apologize. I have a phone that I can't shut off here in the background. I want to make clarity. It's not to challenge anything we heard, but Dale Maggard talked about the proposal for whitetail and stated what the recommendation is. And so certainly want to leave room for everybody to express their opinion, but the current recommendation is not. He's right in that there was confusion. We started with an 8-day season. I added confusion, so I said, why not 9? At least 9 sometimes includes 2 weekends. 8 never does. Regardless, the staff recommendation you're going to hear this afternoon is to maintain the status quo, which is to have a late season that ends on the 19th and includes at least 2 full weekends. So no judgment intended, but that's the recommendation you're going to hear. So I thought I should clarify that so it doesn't just add to confusion this afternoon.
Thank you, and well stated, Director. Okay, that does conclude agenda item 2, open public comment. We are now moving to number 3. This is a director's report, so stay right where you are, Kelly. You got the floor.
Oh, baby. Sir. Yeah, I wouldn't go anywhere right now. So this is an based on trying to get a little more time into our meetings, we agreed to abbreviate this report today. So I'm going to try to cover a lot of things, and probably many of these could take the 15 minutes allotted in themselves. Alternative gear, boy, you've heard a lot already. I think Commissioner Baker did a nice job of describing what we heard yesterday in Fish Committee, where we took a little deeper dive. The Columbia River policy directs us to pursue alternative gears. We've been working that for a while. You've heard some of the concerns today. We've been doing it for a long time, not particularly effectively. Since 2019, we've been working with the advisory group to move forward on alternative gears. And we currently have 3 alternative gears with TAC approved numbers that we can use to go forward. That's beach seine, purse seine, and pound net. A designation would allow us to gather more information. As you've heard today, strong feelings, strong input on both sides of this issue. A lot of support because people see it as an intriguing and exciting alternative, and a lot of resistance saying that let's not rush to judgment. There are a lot of unanswered questions around economic viability. How's the allocation going to be handled? How's the permitting going to be handled? And how's licensing going to be handled are the ones that I'm hearing the most on. Staff have taken all that to heart. Their recommendation to me is to proceed with a designation and feel that by doing so, we could answer a lot of those questions, but recognizing those questions have to be answered. And that this is a first step in a process. It's not a final step in the process. So I'm evaluating all that information. I'm interested, as Commissioner McIsaac said, on commissioner input. I'll divert a little bit that we have to really figure out where that balance is. We're making decisions every day that we can provide and get input on. Obviously, the big ones we want input on more so, and it's not always possible to tell where those will be. So that's a tangential. I look forward to working with you all on how to draw that line. I hope to be making a decision soon. I'll make sure you're all informed on that. And it's important to note, if the decision is to proceed with the designation, that starts a rulemaking process. That goes through our CR 101 step, which is an announcement that we're going to do a rule, and then the entire process to get through to a rule, just to have it established as a designated gear. So plenty of opportunity for input, both from the public and from the commission in the future on that. And I will notify you all before I make a decision, but I want to make that timely as well. I think a lot of the angst out there could be relieved by a decision one way or the other, whether you like it or not. The lack of a decision, I think, just adds to the tensions out there. So I think that's my obligation to do that. I'm going to move